From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, propositions have sometimes been referred to as the fourth branch of government. They give the average Californian the opportunity to directly weigh in on important public policy issues. And while frustration with the legislative process has resulted in a seemingly longer and longer list of propositions over the last 10 years, the number of propositions on this year's ballot is fewer than in the past. But while there are fewer propositions on the ballot than previous years, the topics are just as important. Issues relating to water, the state budget, healthcare, and crime, just to name a few. We'll get the analysis of this year's propositions with five experts from the nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office. They are Anton Feverini-Sorba, Ryan Miller, Ross Brown, Drew Soderberg, and Anita Lee. We'll also hear from Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee, Melinda Morales, the community conversation editor for the Visalia Times Delta, and Jeff Cummins, a professor of political science at California State University, Fresno. The 2014 propositions. Fewer doesn't mean less.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From the California Channel at the state capitol, Valley PBS, and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Our guest is California Legislative Analyst Office expert on water issues, Anton Feverini-Sorba. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about Prop 1, the water bond. How much money of the $7.5 billion is going to be for water supplies, and what types of projects are included?
Yeah, so this is the largest portion of the bond. Maybe just to back up, just to kind of set the stage a little bit on California water supplies. Probably most of your viewers know that we move water from north to south because most of the water is in the north, most of the population's in the south. We also have to store it throughout the year to get it to the places that we need it at the time we need it. We've built a system of canals and pipes to do that, but that's had an effect on the environment, and we have factors such as climate change, so there are some challenges with the water system. This bond has $4.2 billion for new water supplies. 2.7 of that, so most of it, is money for new storage.
Now, when you say new storage, that's not just dams. That's also underground storage as well?
Right. It could be improving our ability to store water in as groundwater. The projects there would be ranked according to basically the return on investment for public dollars. So they're supposed to provide some public benefit. There would be a state agency that would select which projects get funded based on that return.
I want to talk about that in a moment, but I want to ask you a few other questions about Prop 1. One is the money set aside to protect and restore watersheds. How much money is set aside for that?
So there's $1.5 billion for protecting and restoring watersheds. That's split in a couple of different ways. Most of the funding would be set aside for specific parts of the state and kind of all around the state, but some of the money, about $500 million, would be to fulfill some of the state's environmental obligations or commitments that the state has agreed to fund.
So there are some specific projects that are designated that they would get funding under that?
Not exactly. There are a couple of options that might get funding under that, but the legislature would choose amongst those.
Okay. So the other issue is water quality. How much money for water quality?
So there's $1.4 billion for water quality, and that includes both surface water, kind of rivers and streams, but also groundwater quality. Over half of that money would be to clean up contaminated groundwater. Another $260 million would be for drinking water, and $260 for wastewater. Water treatment improvements for people who can't afford it, and then $100 million for helping local agencies develop sustainable groundwater management plans related to the recent legislation.
$100 million here, $100 million there. It starts to add up. That's a big problem. I mean, groundwater contamination is a big problem, isn't it?
Yeah, throughout the state, I think particularly in the southern half of the state.
Right. There's also some money in there for flood protection.
That's right. This is the smallest portion. It's $395 million. Most of that goes to levy levies in the Delta.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So that's where they're really where they're going to focus.
That's right. There'd be $100 million, though, that could go anywhere throughout
the state. Because if there was a breakdown of the levies in the Delta, that'd be catastrophic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there are a variety of estimates, but, you know, damage is on the order of a couple billion dollars.
So maybe $400 million to shore them up might not be a bad idea. Yeah. What about future projects? How are they going to be selected? You were mentioning that the California Water Commission is going to select them. How are they going to select? So we have $2.7 billion for water storage.
Right.
That's not earmarked specifically to projects like Temperance Flat or SiteStem or something.
No, that's right. It could be spent throughout the state, and so there are a variety of public benefits that might be funded. So storage can provide benefits such as flood control, also water supply, and even environmental. So this commission would quantify those benefits, rank the projects that are asking for money, and then give them money without going through the legislative budget process.
So it's not going to be a simple cost-benefit analysis of this is the cheapest way to store water. There are going to be some other
factors
that are considered as well. And who is on that commission?
There are a variety of appointees, mostly appointed by the governor, but a couple legislative appointees.
Okay, so I guess some folks might be concerned about the political aspects of the Water Commission, how they might rule.
Potentially, yeah. They're intended to have kind of balanced interests, some people representing water interests, others environmental.
So I guess we'll see the fight going on, I'm sure, at the California Water Commission if this passes. What about the requirement for matching funds?
Yeah, so most of the funding, $5.7 billion, would require a 50% match primarily by local agencies.
So that's about three-quarters of the money is going to require a match.
That's right.
Okay, last question is fiscal effects on state and local governments.
Yeah, so I think there are two major fiscal effects. One is we're borrowing a significant amount of money if this were to be approved, so we have to repay that. The payments on that would be, we estimate, $360 million a year for about 40 years.
And just to put that into context, we have about $100, $110 billion state budget, so that's, 0.3% of the state budget.
That's right.
But the $7 billion bond over that period of time would cost about $14 billion total after you pay it all. Like
roughly.
Charging your credit card.
Yeah, exactly, or your mortgage.
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and then just to mention the other fiscal effect, it would be on local governments. And so with all this bond funding that might become available, we expect that some of that money would offset money that local governments would spend, likely around $200 million a year.
$200 million.
Yeah. Here and there.
Okay, well, Anton, thank you very much. We're now going to talk about Prop 2, the Rainy Day Fund. Our guest is a California LAO Principal Fiscal and Policy Analyst on the State Budget, Ryan Miller. Welcome to the Manner Report.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ryan, we were talking about in the earlier segment, the state budget is about $100 to $110 billion. What are the biggest sources of revenue for the state budget, and what are their biggest expenditures?
Well, about two-thirds of the general fund revenues, the general fund is the state's main operating account, about two-thirds of their revenues come from the personal income tax, and almost all of the rest comes from the sales and use tax and the corporation tax. Now, out of that about $110 billion, roughly half of it is spent on education, both for K-12 and higher education, as well as community colleges, and most of the rest is spent on health and human services programs.
I think a lot of people are surprised about it. I think a lot of people think the money is spent on prisons. That's not really not the case.
It's a little less than 10% is actually spent on prisons.
And about 50% is spent on education, so quite a big difference.
That's right.
You know, California has been criticized for having a very volatile fiscal structure. What's the problem?
Well, we have a few different types of revenue that are volatile, but one that we've talked a lot about in recent years are capital gains. Revenues that we receive from capital gains taxes are taxed on mostly stocks, other types of property as well. But as the stock market is very unpredictable and goes up and down a great deal, so do our revenues from that tax. Part of the issue for the budget, as far as the state's elected leaders are concerned, is that when those revenues go up, and they can go up very fast, the state has tended to commit those resources to programs. And then when the stock market declines or we hit a recession, we no longer have that revenue base to
still
support
have
our
the
programs. Yeah.
That's
so,
right.
So that's been a big problem for California's budget in recent years.
Well, didn't the voters in 2004 pass Prop 58 to create a budget reserve? I think they called a budget reserve account the BSA, also known as the Rainy Day Fund. Why do we need Prop 2?
Well, some have criticized the BSA as being too easy to suspend. when the big financial crisis hit in 2008, the state suspended its deposits into the BSA for a number of years. This year, we actually put the standard 3% amount in, which is a little over $3 billion this year. But Prop 2 would make a variety of changes, not only to kind of the formula that we use to put money into the reserve, but also some of the rules governing how to take money out and how to put money in.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So what is the change, the basic change in the amount that goes into the reserve? You said 3% under Prop 58. Mm-hmm. The new change would be what?
So it's 3% under current law. The governor can reduce that all the way down to zero if he chooses. In this new version, for the next 15 years, it would be 0.75% of general fund
revenues.
So
less than 1%.
Less than 1%. But then in addition to that, when these capital gains revenues are very strong, a portion of that amount would go in. So in the voter guide analysis, we said that a minimum of about $800 million would be the kind of standard deposit. But then when capital gains revenues are good, they could be $2 billion or even more.
Okay. But it would be a steady stream that's going into that account. Now, taking money out was one of the criticisms of Prop 58. Under this new Prop 2, they have something called a budget emergency. Mm-hmm. It's going to make it a little more difficult to take the money out of the BSA. Can you explain that process a little bit?
A budget emergency would be when the state is facing a natural disaster, such as, you know, the fires that we've had this summer. But in addition, another definition would be when the state can't maintain the amount of spending that it had in recent years, adjusted for inflation and population growth. The governor would declare a budget emergency, but then the legislature would also have to agree by passing a bill.
Okay, both of them. And then we also have something in there about the maximum size of the BSA. It was $8 billion mm-hmm. under Prop 58. What will it be under Prop 2?
Right now it is $8 billion. Under Prop 2, it would be about $10 billion. So it's a slight
more.
Increase, yes.
Okay, and they also have something called state reserves for schools. Why are they setting that up? What is that?
So the state has a formula that establishes a minimum amount of funding for K-12 and community college education. It's based largely on revenues, and since the state's revenues are quite volatile, so is education funding.
That's Prop 98.
That's Prop 98, yes.
Okay. So a lot of propositions here that influence state budget.
Yeah, propositions play a big role in the state budget. Yeah. But this account would tend to receive money less frequently than the standard BSA because some additional conditions would have to be met on the school side in order for money to go into that.
And it also set a maximum that local school districts could keep as a reserve, mm-hmm. correct?
So a new state law that was passed this summer would go into effect if Proposition 2 passes. And when the state would put money into this new state reserve for schools, which we don't think would happen for a few years, but when that happens, the following year, school districts would have a cap on the amount of reserves they could keep at the local school district level.
So what's the fiscal impact of that on local school districts?
Well, it depends on how school districts would react to the new law. Some of them may spend down their reserves quickly. Some school districts have reserves far in excess of these new caps. So some of them might spend down to kind of get ready. Other school districts may wait and spend all at once when the new caps go into effect. But school districts could also petition county education officials to try to get kind of an exemption from these new requirements. And so some of them may seek that instead of spending down their reserves.
So another attempt at ballot budgeting, I guess, more to think about. Well, I want to thank you very much for being here. We're now joined by Ross Brown, an analyst on healthcare issues with the California Legislative Analyst Office. Welcome to the Matter Report, Ross.
Thanks for having me.
So, Prop 45, it would mandate that rates for individual and small group health insurance would have to be approved by the insurance commissioner. So let's provide some background first. Where do Californians get their health insurance?
Most people obtain their health insurance from their employer. They have job-based coverage. A lot of other people have government-sponsored insurance through either the Medicare program or the Medicaid program, which is Medi-Cal in California. And some people purchase their coverage directly from the health insurer, and that's known as individual market coverage. Now, as you mentioned, Prop 45 affects individual market and small group coverage. And small group coverage is defined as coverage for employers that have 50 or fewer employees. And individual and small group coverage represents about 15% of the total California population.
So that's all this would affect?
That's right.
Wow. Okay. Okay. So health insurance rates, how are they currently regulated, if they're regulated, and how would Prop 45 change that current process?
So California has a unique health insurance regulatory setup. There are two different health insurance regulators, the California Department of Insurance and the Department of Managed Health Care, and they each regulate a different type of insurance. Now, currently, health insurance rates for the individual and small group markets, they are reviewed by the appropriate regulator, and the regulator makes a determination of whether or not they feel those proposed rates are reasonable. reasonable or not, and they make that determination public, and they will try to encourage a health insurance company to change the rate if they feel it is unreasonable, but they currently don't have any authority to approve or reject the proposed rates. Now, under Proposition 45, it would give the authority to the insurance commissioner, who heads the Department of Insurance, the authority to reject rate increases that he or she believes unreasonable.
So a simple way to say it is, right now it's voluntary, essentially, a recommendation, and it would change to mandatory.
It would move from simply review to the authority to approve.
Okay. You know, a lot of voters are under the impression that Covered California, which is California's health care exchange that was created under the Affordable Care Act, was going to negotiate rates. What effect would Prop 45 have on Covered California's ability to negotiate health insurance rates?
Covered California would still have the authority to negotiate rates if Prop 45 were to pass. However, those rates that are negotiated and agreed upon between Covered California and the health insurance company would then have to be additionally approved by the insurance commissioner after those are negotiated.
So these aren't mutually exclusive. The two can work, I guess it's going to be in sequence. So they first negotiate the rates, and then if they're acceptable by the insurance commissioner, then they're going to be...
That's the idea, yes.
Okay. Proponents say that it would make health insurance similar to what's already happening with auto and homeowners insurance. Is that a fair analogy?
I think it's fair to say that the general process will be similar to what's currently used for auto and home insurance. And in fact, Proposition 45 uses a lot of the same language that's in Proposition 103, which was the voter initiative that gave the insurance commissioner the authority to approve home and auto rates. So process-wise, I think it'll be very similar. Now, it's difficult to say whether the effect on health insurance will be similar to whatever the effect that rate approval process had on home and auto insurance. Now, health insurance is a very different product. The rate structures are very different, so it's difficult to say whether the effects would be similar.
So we'll give that a maybe. Okay. What about the fiscal effects on state government and ratepayers?
It's very difficult to say what effect this will have on the actual rates themselves and what consumers will pay for rates. Now, on the fiscal side for state government, the most significant effects will be on the administrative costs. There will be some additional administrative costs for the Department of Insurance to review and approve the rates. There may possibly be some additional fiscal effects on Covered California or the Department of Managed health care. All told, the likely costs are they probably won't exceed the low millions of dollars annually, and those costs will be funded by fees paid by health insurance companies.
What about a retiree health that the state covers? Would it impact that as well?
Those aren't individual and small group market products, groups, so they're not subject to the rate approval process
that
would establish. Exactly.
All right, let's talk about Prop 46, and that would add drug and alcohol testing for doctors, as well as increase the amount for jury awards in medical negligence lawsuits from $250,000, which was established in 1975, to $1.1 million, and then adjust that amount going forward for inflation. And I guess they came up with that 1.1 by taking the $250,000 and then just using the rate of inflation to get to what it would be today, which would be $1.1 million. Is it true that doctors are currently not subject to drug and alcohol testing?
That's true. There's no current requirement that hospitals test doctors for drug and alcohol.
I think the people would probably find that a little surprising. Most people really are focusing on that increase in the jury awards from $250,000 to $1.1 million. But that's for medical negligence lawsuits, to be clear. What impact do you think that's going to have on ratepayers and doctors?
It could have a wide variety of different effects, a lot of those effects are subject to a lot of uncertainty. But we identified two different broad categories of potential fiscal effects and cost increases. One is just the direct costs to doctors associated with resolving and paying out medical malpractice claims, and potentially to medical malpractice insurers having to pay higher amounts, and that would show up in medical malpractice premiums. The other effect is on a potential change in doctor behavior and the amounts and types of healthcare services that are provided.
To cover themselves, they'll provide more tests and things of that nature.
Right, yeah, they're at sort of a greater risk for higher medical malpractice claims, and in response to that greater risk, they could change their behavior in a way that either increases or decreases costs. But on net, it would likely increase costs, and altogether, the two costs, both the direct costs for malpractice claims and sort of these changes in the types and amounts of healthcare services, would likely increase costs overall, and those costs would increase by a relatively small percentage amount.
I think I'd read between 1% or 0.5% on healthcare costs. So actually, it's quite small.
A fraction of a percent to maybe a little bit more than 1%.
All right. Okay. I know we're going a little over, but I want to ask one quick question. That is, what impact is this going to have, the increasing the maximum jury award amount, on state and local governments?
State and local governments spend a lot of money on healthcare services, tens of billions of dollars annually. And so those cost increases that we just talked about would be passed on to some state and local government purchasers. And given how much they spend on health insurance, even a small percentage change in those costs could result in an increase ranging from tens of millions of dollars to several hundred millions of dollars annually.
So it's where it's going to impact is the government, essentially.
Payers for healthcare services, which governments are a large payer for healthcare services.
Well, thank you very much for being here. We're now joined by two more experts from the California Legislative Analyst Office, Drew Soderberg and Anita Lee. Welcome to the Matter Report.
Thanks.
So, Drew, let's start with you and talk about Prop 47. What specific crimes would be affected by Prop 47 if it passes? This is the idea of moving some felonies to misdemeanors. What are we talking about?
That's absolutely right. So Prop 47 would require misdemeanor sentences for possessing most illegal drugs for personal use. It would also generally reduce penalties for shoplifting, theft, forging or writing bad checks, and receiving stolen property when these crimes involve $950 or less. Now, one thing that is important to note is it would only reduce penalties for offenders who haven't previously been convicted of certain severe crimes, such as certain sex crimes, murder, and gun-related
crimes. They're not going to be covered.
That's absolutely
right. But if you haven't, then you would be.
That's correct.
All right. So what impact is this going to have on state and county budgets?
Sure. So we estimate that Prop 47 could eventually result in net state savings in the low hundreds of millions of dollars annually. However, the measure does require that the state spend those on certain programs, such as mental health and drug abuse treatment, dropout prevention programs, and victim services. Now, when it comes to the counties, Prop 47 could result in net savings of several hundred million dollars annually, and there wouldn't be any requirements on how the counties spend those dollars.
Okay, so there'd be some savings. Sounds like substantial savings. But you're also then, would these folks be still be monitored by the criminal justice system? Or they're kicked out. I mean, they're released.
So basically what would happen is these offenders would be serving misdemeanor sentences. So they would have, to the extent they're in jail, they would have shorter jail terms. And to the extent they're on community supervision, their terms of supervision would tend to be shorter. So they would still be part of the criminal justice system. Just the nature of the sentence they would serve would be different.
And this may be an unfair question to ask, but I'm just curious. You know, you see a lot of state prisoners going to county jails under realignment. What effect would this have any effect on that? Or do you see more people going from state prisons to county jails?
So it absolutely would result in some offenders who would otherwise serve their term in state prisons serving their term in county jail. However, because it would also reduce the amount of time offenders who are already serving in jail spend in jail, the net effect of those two factors would result in a net reduction in the number of, it would basically free up jail beds.
Okay.
Now, there's a lot of counties that have overcrowding problems, so you might not see a reduction in the overall size of the jail population of a commensurate magnitude, because it might just result in some counties not releasing folks early like they had.
I guess you're seeing more people come in, but more people going out as well.
That's correct.
Okay, and let's talk about Prop 48. That's the casino proposition, for a lack of a better way to say this. What can you tell us about Prop 48?
Sure. So if voters approve the proposition, two gaming compacts between the state and two Indian tribes, the North Fork Rancheria of Mono Indians and the Wiat tribe, would go into effect. Also going into effect would be some local agreements with governmental agencies. Practically, what this means is that the North Fork tribe would be able to move forward with the construction and operation of a casino with up to 2,000 slot machines on land that was acquired near State Highway 99 in Madera County, approximately 38 miles from the tribe's reservation. At the same time, the Wiat tribe up in Humboldt County would be prohibited from gaming near their tribal lands near a wildlife refuge in exchange for a share of the revenues from the North Fork. for a casino.
So they get a little money without having to have a casino there. So opponents say, listen, this is going to get create a greater demand for government services. Proponents say, hey, but the city and county are going to make a lot more money. They're going to be well compensated. Mm-hmm. What do your projections show?
So the first thing I would say is that, you know, it's really difficult to predict what the impact of a casino will be before it opens. And so the compacts and various local agreements that North Fork has already entered into with some of the local governments makes an attempt to kind of anticipate those costs. So in our analysis, we estimated that the local governments would receive between $16 to $35 million in one-time payments and between $5 to $8.5 million in ongoing payments annually. Similarly, the state would receive revenues to offset increased costs, you know, for, you know, increased regulation, et cetera.
Yeah, there's some money there, but also the casino is going to be making, I think, hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So it's all balanced up. I guess people can read up on it and decide how they want to vote. I want to thank our guests, Anita Lee, Drew Soderberg, also Ryan Miller and Anton Favorini-Sorba for being with us.
Up next, while there are only six propositions on this November's ballot, all will have a direct effect on the Valley. We'll talk to Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor of the Fresno Bee, Melinda Morales, the community conversation editor for the Visalia Times-Delta, and Jeff Cummins, a political science professor at Fresno State, and get their take on the propositions. That conversation in a moment.
From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We've got three viewpoints on what the upcoming propositions might mean for the Valley. They are Melinda Morales, the community conversation editor for the Visalia Times-Delta. Welcome, Melinda.
Good morning.
Jeff Cummins, professor of political science at California State University, Fresno. Welcome, Professor Cummings.
Thank you.
I think I said Cummings. I meant Cummins. I apologize. And Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, let's start, Bill, with you. Prop 1, the water bond, certainly has everyone's attention. What do you think? Is it a good deal for the Valley?
Well, I think it's a good deal for the Valley. I mean, we certainly saw that because Valley lawmakers held together during the negotiations to put it on the ballot, and that included both Republicans and Democrats. And during their campaigns now leading up to November 4th, you see candidates citing their bipartisan approach to, helping us with the California drought and taking care of future water needs. So to me, if you look at the bond, I believe it's a pretty good deal for the Valley.
What do you think, Melinda, in Visalia? What were they saying in Visalia? Do they think this is a good deal for the Valley?
Oh, yeah, I think so, because for the first time, it really focuses on the needs of the Central Valley and how dependent we are on water year-round to, you know, produce all the food and maintain all the jobs, and it's essentially a way of life. You know, when it rains a lot, which is not often in the Central Valley, we're not even on the radar of those living to the north of us. So this long-term drought, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it's forced the rest of the state to kind of pay attention to what we do and at least elevate our needs to those of other areas.
You know, Professor Cummins, they have, in the water bond, there's a matching requirement. About three-quarters of the funds require a matching requirement, which is about 50% from local communities. What do you think? Does that still make it a good deal for the Valley?
Yeah, no, I still think that makes it a good deal. I mean, there's a lot in there for some of the real pressing needs that our outlying communities are facing with polluted water and wastewater treatment problems. So, yeah, I definitely would agree that it's a good deal for our area.
You know, it's interesting that $2.7 billion of this measure is going to go to new water storage. But they don't define that specifically as dams. In fact, what they're saying is the California Water Commission is supposed to make that determination based on what's the most efficient use of the funds. Professor Cummins, do you see that maybe stopping the development of something like a temperance flat and putting more of that money into groundwater?
Well, it seems like they punted on that political issue and kicked it over to the commission. But, you know, it's hard to say whether or not we'll end up seeing a dam or not. My guess is that we probably will. Whether or not that's the most efficient way to store water, I'm not real sure. I'm pretty much leaning towards more storage in the aquifers underground. because of the evaporation problems with dams.
Bill, you know, you, as the editorial page editor of the Fresno Bee, I mean, you've talked a lot about the importance of water issues in the region, obviously. What do you think? Are you concerned at all about this $2.7 billion being decided by the California Water Commission?
Well, I think that, you know, when these negotiations were going on, certainly those in the discussions thought, oh, this money is for above-ground storage. You know, it turns out it's for storage. It could be underground. It could be above ground. But, you know, before you're going to build a dam in California, the reality is you're going to have to show that it pencils. And what do we mean by that it pencils? That it's, you know, it has multiple benefits, and that these benefits can't be done, you know, more for less money in another way. And so all the dams are going to have to go through that. I think this, what we're seeing here is just a reflection of reality. And I also think that, you know, the Northern California dam site has a lot more bipartisan support in general. And I think just if you look at people in Washington, D.C., and then influential lawmakers in California, they see temperance as really it's going to have to prove itself, and it's way down on the list.
You know, one of the things that seems like a lot of even environmentalists seem to support is raising like San Luis Dam Reservoir to capture more water there. So that's going to be an interesting fight going forward. I want to ask you, Melinda, with the Visalia Times Delta, what your thoughts are about the fact that the governor's Twin Tunnels project was specifically excluded from the water bond. Do you think we can solve the water problem without dealing with Delta conveyance?
Well, I'm not sure about that, because if you're looking at other methods of solving our water problem, like groundwater storage, conservation. I mean, conservation is kind of a sore subject around here because it's a way of life for Central Valley. You know, we've been asked repeatedly, as the whole state has it, to conserve. But farmers aren't water wasters, and neither are the millions of people that live in this area or are some way connected to or dependent upon that industry here. We've been in some sort of elevated water conservation mode for years. Some more than others, but a lack of awareness or extreme conservation, that's not really what's needed here, at least not in the Central Valley.
Professor Cummins, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, was this a political move to not deal with the governor's Twin Tunnels project, to keep it keeping that separate from this measure?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, it looks like they just pulled that out and didn't want that to be part of this, and saw some of the other water needs across the strait as a higher priority right now, and especially given the drought situation. So, I mean, I think that's a good idea because the bond is going to put a major dent in the state's water supply needs. So there were specific provisions put in there to not fund the governor's Twin Tunnels project.
You know, Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bee. So we're not dealing with the Twin Tunnels project. I mean, what are your thoughts on this? Are we going to be seeing another bond in the not-too-distant future dealing with that issue?
Well, here's the deal about the water bond that the voters are going to vote on November 4th, or they're voting on it right now by mail. There's no way they would have got this agreement to put this up if the Twin Tunnels had been in there. I mean, there's no way. It's too controversial. And also, there have been setbacks to the governor's Twin Tunnel plans throughout this year. So I think Governor Brown is basically, sitting it out and trying to figure out where the next step is going to be. You got to remember, when you're looking at the Twin Tunnels, it doesn't create more water. The idea was by moving the water around the Delta and restoring the Delta, you were going to help the fish populations, help wildlife, do all the things that you need to do there. But, you know, they really haven't proven that this will work. And, you know, that's the big development of this year. The other thing is, who's going to pay for the Twin Tunnels? And you have, major water groups, Metropolitan Water and Southern California, presumably Westlands. They stand to benefit from this, but who else is going to benefit from it? And then you got to figure out, you know, the stakeholders, how much of this cost are they going to bear? There, you know, there are a lot of ag groups that don't believe in the Twin Tunnels project either, and they're sitting on the sidelines. So to me, the fate of Twin Tunnels is very much up in doubt.
Okay. Well, Professor Cummins, let's switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about another proposition that impacts the Valley, and that's at the other end of the propositions. That's Proposition 48, which is a referendum on the Indian Gaming Compact with the North Fork Rancheria of Mono Indians. And I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, the Wyatt Tribe. It would allow the North Fork Rancheria of Mono Indians to construct and operate a new casino on Route 99 in Madera County, about 38 miles from the reservation. And it would be required to make various payments to state and local governments, as well as the Wyatt and other tribes. What are your thoughts on Prop 48?
Well, we've seen a lot of these compacts and over the last decade or so where the governor negotiates with these different tribes to build a casino, and then it has to go to the voters for approval. So in that regard, this is fairly typical. I would say that the unusual part of this one, though, is that it's considered to be off-reservation, that is, not on the tribe's native grounds. And so the concern is that it's going to set a precedent for other tribes that are going to want to try and build casinos off of their historical tribal lands. And so if this one goes forward, we could see more throughout the state. Now, in terms of the impact on the Valley, and particularly Madera, I would say that this would probably have a pretty positive impact on their economy. You're probably going to get some travelers pulling off of the 99 and going in there and spending some of their money. So I would say that this would be a overall positive for Madera's county, and it's probably going to draw some of the patrons and clients away from the other surrounding casinos in the outlying communities.
Bill McEwen, you're with the Fresno Bee. Madera is just north of Fresno. What are your thoughts? Is this good for Madera County? Is it good for Fresno County?
Well, I'll give you the opinion of the Bee editorial board. One, it's not good for Madera County. And if you do any kind of economic analysis on casinos, they're not income generators. I mean, they take money out of people's pockets and they don't move on and create new business. To us, is that a dangerous precedent, and it isn't what the voters approved when they approved Indian gaming. These casinos are supposed to be on Indian land, so we look at this as reservation shopping. And then finally, just take a look at what's going on at Chickchansey. The last thing California needs is another Indian gaming casino.
Well, Melinda Morales, you're in Visalia, a little bit further removed from Madera County. What are your thoughts on having this be placed in Madera County along Route 99? What impact do you think it's going to have on the Valley as a whole?
Well, gaming and the Valley are not two concepts that I necessarily pair together. So the idea of putting a casino along the highway, you know, off of the reservation land is, you know, it's pretty obvious that it's just it wants to become a destination. But when I think of destination gaming, I'm not thinking of Madera or even any some of the other areas here within the Central Valley. It could be a good, you know, fiscal positive impact for Madera County. But there are so many other things that sustain a gaming industry, and I think location is pretty key to that. I mean, when Las Vegas was developed, as long ago as it was no place. It was out in the middle of nothing. And, you know, I guess you could kind of see a parallel there, but I really can't see Madera becoming a destination, which is what I think gaming needs to be. As my colleague was saying earlier, it's not necessarily a moneymaker. There's other things that need to support it, and I'm not sure that any of those things exist in this area.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the tagline, what happens in Madera. Well, we'll leave that one alone. Bill, Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bee, let's go back and talk about Prop 2, the Rainy Day Fund. It places a cap on school district reserves. Is that good or bad for the Valley?
Well, I guess that would depend on, you know, the health of the individual school districts. I wouldn't want to hazard a guess on, you know, Valley-wide what's going on. I mean, I think in general, Proposition 2. It's not a perfect piece of legislation, but it's a good piece of legislation. And again, they've been fighting in Sacramento and negotiating on this thing for years and years and years, and they're finally, you know, putting something on the ballot. And I would hope that voters would back it. I mean, it seems to me a lot of voters have been saying they recognize California kind of has this boom or bust income situation, and they've been saying we expect our lawmakers to save for a rainy day and not spend all the money every year. We try to avoid these up and down cycles. So that said, the last poll I saw showed that Proposition 2 was failing, and it's going to be interesting to see if once again Governor Brown can put all his political capital, you know, invest it all, get out there and pull Proposition 2 to victory. I've noticed in the last couple of days he's talking more about Proposition 2. He's been on social media, I think, in an attempt to educate younger voters about Prop 2. But again, as I say, in the last poll, it showed that Proposition 2 would not pass.
Melinda Morales, what's your sense with the Visalia Times Delta? What is your sense on Prop 2? Is that good or bad for the Valley?
Well, for the same reasons, it's hard for me to know if I really understand why there's the cap on the school district reserves. That's the only part that I think is kind of puzzling. But I agree that it's not perfect, but it does require the forced savings, and I think that's about the only way anybody, business, government, individual, ever saves is when they're forced to, and it's got to be part of the budget, because something always comes along to blow up the budget. So what this doesn't do, though, is address spending. Of course, there's always an allowance for emergencies, but it seems to be focused on paying down debt and the unfunded liabilities, and so for those reasons, I'm willing to say, okay, it's not perfect, but it's pretty good.
Okay, well, Professor Cummins, I'm going to let you have the last word on this, and here's my question. You know, you look at poll after poll, and they say, the voters say, you know, the state budget process is a problem. Yet, as Bill McEwen's mentioned, you know, this particular proposition on the Rainy Day Fund, which tries to address the state budget process, does not have majority support. Can you explain the disconnect?
Well, I mean, I think in this case, if we're talking about, it was a Public Policy Institute California poll, and there was 43% support, and there was about a quarter of the respondents who don't know, right? They don't have an opinion. So as the governor ramps up his campaign in support of it, I would imagine that a good chunk of those are going to go to the yes side and that eventually this will pass. And in particular, because when these measures come out of the legislature, as this one did, they tend to have a very high passage rate, and that's because in order to put them, to package up these measures, you have to get a lot of stakeholders on board, and so there's very little opposition to it. There's a few education groups that are opposed to it, but they're not going to have the money that the pro side is going to have. Now, having said that, I think the overall idea is a good one. I mean, most people are going to agree with the fact that we need to have a more adequate reserve. But having said that, I think they mucked it up and they made it much more complicated than it needed to be. And I'm pretty doubtful that it's going to put enough money in a reserve to get us through the next recession without having to make some pretty major budget reductions.
Well, you started off so optimistic, and then you came back a little bit on that. Well, listen, when we come back, we're going to have a discussion on the propositions on health, healthcare, and crime. What are the implications for the San Joaquin Valley if they pass? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580-1059 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking about the November propositions and how they might impact the San Joaquin Valley with Jeff Cummins, professor of political science at California State University, Fresno, Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee, and Melinda Morales, the community conversation editor for the Visalia Times Delta. And Melinda, let me start with you. I want to talk about Prop 45, which would mandate that rates for individual and small group health insurance would have to be approved by the insurance commissioner. What are the implications for the Valley?
Well, I'm inclined to be skeptical whenever anyone says that a proposal, particularly legislation, is going to make anything more affordable, especially coming off the heels of the Affordable Care Act, particularly health care legislation. The seemingly duplicative efforts of this legislation, I think, are just going to set the stage for a painfully slow process, even though what we've been told over the years is that, in attempts to curb auto insurance rates, they've had some success. I'm less confident about that happening in healthcare. But what I do find appealing is the idea that this whole process would be open to the public. And even though I like that, it still seems to me that it's somewhat maybe premature, I don't know if that's the right word or not, to be tackling rates. While essentially we're still rolling out the Affordable Care Act under California Covered, and still having, real issues with it. In fact, we're not even really still clear about what the effects the Affordable Care Act is going to have on the quality and availability of locally provided health care and its effects on physicians. And that's a major issue in the very rural Central Valley.
Bill, do you have a difference of opinion on that, or do you agree?
Bill McKim with Fresno Bay. Well, the way I look at it is 35 other states give this power to the insurance commissioner, where this has been enacted elsewhere. They've seen significant reduction in rates. When Californians passed Proposition 103 in 1987, our auto insurance rates were going through the roof, and a lot of money's been saved, billions of dollars over the last 25 years or so. So I say give the insurance commissioner this power. It's going to be good for people in the Valley. And I recognize that, yes, the Affordable Care Act, we're just getting used to it. Things are rolling out with Covered California. But that doesn't mean that we can't entrust this power to the insurance commissioner. And quite frankly, I find the no on 45 ads hilarious, considering if you realize who's funding them. So I'm hoping that Proposition 45 passes.
Well, now I'm going to look out for those ads. Professor Cummins, let's talk about Prop 46. That's going to add drug and alcohol testing for doctors, but that's not really getting people's attention. What's getting people's attention is the increase in the amount a jury could award for medical negligent lawsuits from $250,000, which was set in 1975, to $1.1 million, and adjust that amount for inflation in the future. What do you think the implications are for the Valley?
Well, I mean, I think the overall concern with this measure is that it could increase medical costs because doctors would have to pay out more if there are medical malpractice claims that go against them. Now, of course, it looks like, at least from the estimates that have been done, that it would be a pretty negligible increase in medical costs. I know there's a lot of attention that goes towards the fact that if you increase these types of damage awards, it's going to increase medical care costs overall, and it doesn't look like that when you actually look at the numbers. That there are other major factors that increase medical care costs. But my feeling on these measures and just a lot of these initiatives is that they end up being so complicated and so many different elements get put into them, which is the case with this one. It has three major issues involved with it, it's probably not a good idea. However, if you separate them out, I think they're probably all good ideas, but I don't know. I just don't like to see these types of real complicated measures on the ballot and putting the burden on citizens to try and weigh in on them.
Yeah, okay. Well, Bill McKeown, I want to talk a little bit about Prop 47. That would change certain non-serious, non-violent felonies to misdemeanors. What are the implications for the Valley's county jails and budgets?
Well, that's a concern we have, and it's why the Fresno Bee Editorial Board says to vote no on Proposition 47. And we say that even though we have advocated for sentencing reform. At this point, we're still dealing with the effects of Assembly Bill 109, or realignment as it is called. In addition, Governor Brown has indicated that there are going to have to be fixes to AB 109. And we had the modification of the three strikes law that the voters approved recently. So from our standpoint, Proposition 47 is a little too soon. You know, we've had some changes in sentencing and in how our county jails and our state prisons work. We're under federal orders to reduce the number of prisoners still in the state prisons. We're saying hold off on Proposition 47 for now.
Melinda Morales, how does the Visalia Times Delta feel about this proposition?
Well, for many of the reasons that have been stated before, it's something that, you know, the part I think that we think is most appealing is the fact that any savings from housing felons would be, or at least the bulk of it, would be directed to mental health programs and drug addiction programs and kind of rehabilitation programs. And in this area, in Central Valley, we've had, you know, we've seen a rise in that transient population that that would be affected by those funds. So that's just kind of a small part of it. Where I think we'd see even more petty crime in the Central Valley, and this is where a lot of people seem to gravitate. But those smaller crimes that seem to be so, you know, supposedly innocuous, those really affect small business. And the small businesses, and we're talking about, you know, petty theft and shoplifting and check forgery and things like that. You know, those are businesses that are always struggling to stay alive in California. So I can't see how this, other than that one aspect of rehabilitation, and this may be one of the few efforts that we've seen to actually put dollars toward that, I don't know if it's enough.
Okay, well, I've only got about a minute left in the show, and I want to ask you, though, about this SB 1253, which was recently signed by the governor, and some believe it represents a substantial change in the initiative process here in California. So we'll start with you, Professor Cummins. Do you agree that this is a major change in the initiative process, and is it good or bad for the state and or the valley?
Well, I don't know that I would categorize it as a major change. It's you know, tinkering around the edges of what I think is a broken process. And, you know, as I've said, these measures are just so complicated. And the real issue is whether or not we want to put the burden on voters to try and figure out what to do on these measures. But, you know, having said that, I think there's some improvements to the system. You know, a 30-day waiting period before the title and summary is issued so that opponents and others can take a look at it is probably a good idea. I think it has a list of supporters and opponents and financial backing, which would increase transparency. So I think that's a good idea as well. But in general, I mean, it's just really hard with these measures to try and make some sense out of them.
We've only got about 20 seconds left in the segment. I want to get Bill and Melinda's opinions on this. Quickly, Bill, what are your thoughts on 1253? A good change?
I think it's a good change. I agree with the professor. It's incremental. League of Women Voters of California have endorsed it. And the key that they see is that with this extra time, perhaps those in the legislature will engage the proponents and find ways to you know, take legislative action instead of leaving it up to the voters.
Okay, Melinda Morales, you get the last word with Visalia Times Delta.
And I say yes. I think voters have enough to contend without having to wonder whether what made it on the ballot is what's really intended. So the less they have to decipher, the better.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank all of our guests, Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee, Jeff Cummins, professor of political science at California State University, Fresno, and Melinda Morales, the community conversation editor for the Visalia Times Delta. Thanks all of you for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, the Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.